Frances is in Tanzania, so she won't be here. Or someplace, she's somewhere. Not exactly sure. Anyway. So tonight we're supposed to talk about standards of care. We've talked about this a little bit in the past, kind of like passing by. And before I dig into that, I guess I should say something. I know that she talked last week, she talked about the grading, so we do apologize for not getting these to you back to you sooner. The grades, they're kind of like ballpark. You can't really do badly on these things. Everybody's doing fine. They're just kind of giving you an assessment of what we're looking for. So I've got some comments in that. If you've got comments, that means I actually responded. If I didn't, then you're probably doing okay. One of the things you really want to do, though, is when you use this, is not only identify the issues, but also draw on the kind of guidance documents that we have. You know, pull them in. I mean, one of the things you're looking for is to kind of like draw on the correct. I mean, we're looking for you to be able to identify the real issues and not kind of overshoot the non-issues. I mean, in any case, you can always kind of make up facts and make up things that aren't part of the case, and say there's an issue here. And you know, we've talked about this before. So what we're looking for is the specificity of your comment, the sensitivity and specificity of your comments, and drawing on those the guidance the documents. So do cite the guidance when you can. And so that's what really that's what we want you to come out of this with. All right. So the standard of care, I gave you a paper just now that discusses the standard of care for a U.S. trial. And I figured before we kind of launch into the international standard of care issues, that would be worthwhile talking about standard of care here, because it can get a little murky, right? So what is a standard of care? What is a standard of care? Anybody know, generally? You don't have to read the paper now. And it's there, we'll talk about it. But so what's a standard of care?
Accepted medical treatment for diseases and things like that?
Yeah, accepted by whom?
The medical community, I guess.
Is there a medical community?
Make one of the doctors answer.
And sometimes there are recommendations. I mean, there are professional standards for recommendations published medical evidence-based standards that folks use. But there's also the sort of generally accepted practice.
Right. Generally accepted practices. Technically, a standard of care is kind of a range of things that people do under the same circumstances. And it doesn't have to be one particular thing. It can be a number of things. And it's generally accepted by, to answer the question I asked you, it's generally accepted by a reasonable minority. In law, you have to go, of course, for somebody to be held negligent, they have to establish what the standard of care was and say, well, therefore, the doctor did or did not kind of meet that standard. Of course, the standard is a very ephemeral thing oftentimes, and as long as it's some reasonably recognized minority of physicians practice in a particular way and would have in the instant case, then that physician can't really be held as having violated the standard. So that really kind of creates one standard. The problem in the case that I've given you here discusses an area where there's true ambiguity in how to treat people, right? And this is for people who have severe lung injury or acute respiratory distress syndrome. So the question was, in part, is, well, do you treat people with high pressure, which guarantees that a lot of oxygen is getting into the lung, but can create, basically stretches out the alveoli in the lung, if that's how you say the word, and can create lung and cause lung damage? Or do you underinflate, risking the fact that they're not going to get enough lung into oxygen into the bodies? That's my lay kind of interpretation of the problem. So a network of people interested in ARDS was created, ARDSnet. They were funded by the NHLBI, National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, to run a clinical trial. And what they did is they basically said, they looked at extant practices and they said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to try a low pressure and a high pressure. And they picked the high pressure. If you read the paper by Mann, Howard Mann, if you read the piece by Mann, he basically says, you know, they kind of like looked at the literature and they chose a comparator group. So they chose like 6 pounds, 6 PSI in the lung, or 12 PSI. And the 12 PSI wasn't based on any kind of real extant practices. They knew it was within the range of practices, but they picked it so that they would have a big difference to detect. Right? which seems, on its face, it seems like somewhat problematic. And they ran this trial. The trial was actually stopped early because people in the high pressure group were dying at a much substantially higher rate than people in the uncontrolled group, in the treatment group. And so they wrapped up the trial early, and then they published the results in the, where was it published? New England. Yeah. It was published in, I have the trial here. No, the clinical trial was published in the New England Journal in 2000, and it immediately became a subject of large controversy. And Mann, on page 2 in this table, talks about the chronology of the controversy. And it followed fairly quickly. There were some researchers at the NIH that came out and basically said this was really unethical, that you kind of chose to tell BSI. They did a meta-analysis, and they showed that the median of published studies in ARDS seemed to use a pressure of about 10 PSI. So the 12 PSI was clearly exceeding that only, in fact, in their little meta-analysis, which is down at the bottom of their second page. He kind of reproduces the figure. Only about 28% of people actually use pressures exceeding 12 PSI. So their choice seemed to have been really, really problematic. But that raises the question, so what should they have done? And, you know, you've got a range of practices. You're trying, the basic idea is that, you know, high pressure is bad, low pressure is good. And some people think that low pressure is not, you know, other people think the opposite. So what do you do? How can you study it?
Yeah, so just one other point, it's not as simple. It's just to point out the complexity of it. It's sort of this horseshoe curve. So, you know, there's an optimal pressure somewhere under certain sets of circumstances, and that's what people don't know, where that optimal. Too high is bad, too low is bad. Mm-hmm. Where's the optimum? And that was part of the controversy here, too.
So one of the things, based on the criticism, one of the things that they did, and I got a little bit worked up over this, if you look at page 549, the second page of the paper that I gave you, in the criticism of the trial paragraph, it says, the reference to routine care followed a publication in 2000 which revealed that prior to randomization, patients in the participating centers were ventilated with a mean tidal volume of 10.3. Right? And that the mortality in the group of eligible non-participating patients was lower in those randomized to the 12 mil arm the people who refused to participate in the study did better than the people who were put into the trial and got randomized to 12 PSI. Which suggests that, in itself, that suggests that the 12 PSI was A, harmful, and also that it wasn't, they were really in equipoise. They couldn't really choose that arm. And they didn't have any real basis for choosing 12 PSI. Or the basis, which was to kind of maximize difference, was really kind of problematic in itself. But anyway, the way they got at that result, of course, is what they did is they had asked people to participate in the study. I guess a good number of people must have refused, because then they were able to go back and look at refusers. And they did that with a waiver of consent. And Paul Lankin, who was one of the ARDSnet investigators here at Penn, said, yeah, we got a waiver of consent to go back and kind of like look at these retrospectively. And I was like, well, what part of no didn't you understand? Once you ask them to participate, and this is one of the reasons people are really kind of get a little bit dicey about wanting or not wanting to ask somebody to participate, because once they say no, you're kind of bound by the answer. And here, people didn't want to participate in the trial? No. Well, guess what? They went back and put them into the trial. Not prospectively, obviously, but they actually put their data into the study. And the fact that they had said no didn't influence the IRB in, I guess, allowing that retrospective analysis, which, sorry, I'll say it differently, which I think is somewhat problematic in itself. I mean, remember, people are vulnerable to the extent that they can't, you know, vote with their consent, and in this case, they voted, and they were nonetheless their data was collected, and they were used anyway. But so, what do you think? Any ideas what to do?
Well, couldn't they have done the kind of meta-analysis themselves before starting?
Yeah.
To figure out what should our max and minimum
Right. I mean, in some sense, it raises the question, what should they have done to kind of, you know, like, set what the comparator was? And in a way, they could have done a meta-analysis. They could have looked at extant practices. They had an idea. There were some studies out there already, and they already had, in fact, they already had data that suggested that low PSI works and works better and was safer, so which questions the trial in itself. But they didn't do that. They could have also, and what Howard Mann suggests is that they go back and out and survey. So one of the ways to kind of understand what people are doing is go out and survey docs and say, well, you know, what are you doing? And what's the range of practices? And there's lots of ways to kind of do technology assessment. And for instance, the RAND appropriateness study is kind of methodology, which is a kind of a modified Delphi technique for going to physicians with all the indications for particular treatments and getting doctor, eliciting from doctors, and then kind of like getting expert opinions and then kind of iterating a few times to get people to kind of hone in on what the appropriate indications are for particular treatments. And this methodology has been proved in some cases as being pretty powerful.
Yeah. Or they could have done, as we were dancing around a little bit, a cohort study. You know, they could have just sort of enrolled people at all sorts of different pressures. We'll just use that metric here. And try to, you know, figure out what, you know, from that cohort study, you know, what are the range of pressures that it seemed like that there was a positive effect, and then going to a, you know, into a randomized trial. That way, they would have had some, you know, some initial data and some outcome data to be able to model this a little bit better. So that was part of the problem, I think, was just they were using expert opinion. You know, they were just using expert opinion too much on this, and it sort of trickled in directions in which it shouldn't have.
Right. And they had, and to be fair to them, they had some kind of, there was some survey work done and showed that, you know, some doctors basically reported using between 6 and 9 PSI, and another big set of doctors reported be using between 10 and 13 PSI. So within those, they had this kind of bimodal kind of distribution of what doctors reported doing from the early 1990s. So that's what they kind of used to set their two standards, which, you know, and one of the problems, of course, is that between 1990, when that published paper was published with this survey, and when they actually started the trial 4 or 6 years later, you know, things may have actually changed. So they're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. But it does raise the question. I mean, sometimes there is no standard of care. You know, there is nothing that, or it's very hard to kind of put your fingers on what the appropriate comparator is. And that wiggle room is, of course, somewhat dangerous because what Mann calls, I think, is there's a... Hold on a second. Which we've talked about here, comparator bias. This idea that you're going to pick your comparison group to favor your product. Right. And this can go on, and it can go on especially when there's wiggle room in the definition of the standard of care. Anyway, so this is interesting. I know that the ARDSnet investigators really took this to, you know, they took the criticism very, very seriously.
Well, it was, I think it raises the issue of what do you do if there's really no standard, if there's no gold standard. That was what they were sort of wrestling with. They didn't, right. You know, people have been playing with ventilators and didn't understand what the right thing to do was for years and years and years, and there wasn't any data. That's why they set up ARDSnets in the first place. It's like, we don't understand this. We need to do something.
So did the trial answer the question?
Maybe not.
Well, it does say don't use 12 PSI. Yeah. But it turns out that a minority of physicians might have been doing that anyway. And they may have been doing it also under very controlled circumstances. I mean, one of the problems with the trial, of course, is that it's not the external validity of it is maybe somewhat limited. You don't know when doctors are using 12 PSI if they're doing it with more healthier patients who have different kinds of indications and can actually withstand it, or are they actually killing people? You know, you really don't know whether or not the trial result, you know, is meaningful outside of it. And that's the difference between, I think we've talked about it here, the difference between efficacy and effectiveness. So efficacy is within the trial, and effectiveness is what actually happens when it's in the real world. Exactly. So, any other questions about this one? Observations? Okay. So the second study I wanted to talk about is similar. Well, it's not similar. It's actually I didn't give you a copy of anything. If anybody wants it, I can distribute the papers on this. But it was published 3 years ago now. It's the NICE, and anybody who took my research ethics class has heard me talk about this. But it's the NICE sugar study, and this all relates also. It's kind of informative about the naming of studies, right? NICE sugar, right? Or it was Ards. Well, ArdsNet was okay. That was right. But Nice Sugar is a, it's basically it was a randomized clinical trial looking at very tight blood glucose control level in critically ill patients. So basically, there's a standard of care. People just kind of like doing standard care. And I guess the hypothesis here was that if you control people's blood sugar really tightly, so you bring it down and then you try to manipulate it, so make sure that they don't become hypoglycemic, but you're just trying to keep the sugars from going too high, maybe they'll do better. Sorry. This trial was run between a bunch of different institutions in New Zealand, Australia, and Canada. Right. I'm not sure what year is. I don't have it. I know you exactly what years of hand. But it was within the last decade. And this is published in the New England Journal in 2009. But the trial basically enrolled, run some 6,000 people, 6,000 people between the Canadian and New Zealand and Australian sites. In Australia and New Zealand, they had permission, it's legal, to use what's basically a waiver of consent, what they called a retrospective or a delayed consent. So the issue here is these people are very ill, they're in the ICUs, they're not going to eat for the next 24 hours, that's one of the entry criteria. And in Canada, they were not allowed to use this waived consent. Right. So in Canada, they had to actually ask the patients themselves or a surrogate of the patient. And I'm not going to put the data up. Their publication doesn't describe in enough detail to know exactly the breakdown of how many people were in Canada were actually asked. But at the end of the day, they had 5,300 people recruited. Enrolled into the trial in Australia and New Zealand, and 755 in Canada. And it looks like it wasn't one-to-one, but they also had 1,200 refusals. They also had 1,600 people, arguably all in Canada, who could not provide consent for one reason or another and didn't have a surrogate available. So those people were knocked out right in the beginning, but then they had 1,200 people who refused. And the indication, I mean, if you think that most of those refusers are coming in Canada, right, it suggests that you get, you know, it's essentially 1,200 out of 2,000 are refusing. So six out of 10 are refusing to participate in the study. Right. So, and it's, I mean, again, this is a very vulnerable population because we're waiving their consent, right? Or they're unconscious and we're asking a family member for consent. It'd be actually interesting to look at whether or not the surrogates gave a consent and the patients, when competent, were actually refusing or not. That'd be a kind of an interesting subset of this. But none of this data is really available. All we know is that a lot of people in Canada appear to have refused to participate, and which undermines the idea that a waiver is okay. I mean, one of the unstated conditions for a waiver of consent is that if asked, people would participate. Right? I mean, it's this idea that you have a privilege to kind of put people in. Like within clinical medicine, there is a privilege to administer care when someone is unable to consent. But there is a presumption behind the law that allows this that says, well, under most circumstances, somebody would not refuse life-sustaining or, you know, life-preserving care if they're in extremis. And in research, we don't, you know, it's not a stated condition. I mean, there's a couple of commentators who have stated this unofficially, but I mean, what the regulations never say this, and they arguably should. But if you think, well, isn't it, I mean, if the IRB was considering this and considering a waiver, wouldn't they consider, well, is this acceptable? Should this be acceptable to most people? And that's what I think this trial raises the point, is that, you know, if asked, are you going to say yes or not? And can we believe, or do we really believe that people would say yes if asked? And this one basically says that for this kind of study, at least, no. Any thoughts?
So was this exception from informed consent, and they asked once they regained consciousness for consent?
Yes.
They got rid of their data?
I don't know if they got rid of their, I mean, they may have withdrawn their data. It turns out that less than 1% of patients in New Zealand, when asked, withdrew. Withdrawn either by the patient or the surrogate. So very few people withdrew, which makes sense. And that former studies done in the United States on clinical trials where they got a waiver of consent afterwards in emergency research, they asked people afterwards, you know, is it okay that you participated? And, you know, 95, 96% of people usually say yes. And so very few people are actually upset by the that. But in this case, it was somewhat more problematic, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's because of the nature of the study or not. I don't know. And there's no publication on this issue. So I've actually asked the investigator if they have any more details about this.
Yeah, no, just that's what I was asking. Because it's, tight glucose control was in vogue, you know, and so why, what was there unique about the study that actually resulted in you saying to get tight glucose control?
Well, it turns out that mortality was higher in the treatment arm, yeah, right, and in the controls. And
presumably nobody knew that beforehand.
Yeah, presumably. So maybe that, I mean, it was published in the New England Journal, so maybe that was a good thing if people thought that this was a good thing to do, and it turned out that it's not a good thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. Right. But that's still not a reasonable explanation. I mean, because a priori they could have done.
Yeah, because the hypothesis at the time was that
that was good.
Yeah,
they
demonstrated that. Yeah.
Right. So it was a negative result, I guess. That was a negative result, actually. It was a really important result if people, you know, if that was the way medicine was going without the evidence to support it. So, but it still kind of undermines the fact that, you know, you have a very vulnerable population, and we're just kind of tromping on their rights because, oh, it's somewhat impracticable to get their consent. And the funny thing is that also, you know, they didn't say enough about Canada. They didn't really talk about the ethics in this paper at all. And it's like, and it really begs the question. It's like, well, why did you have to do it? If you could do it in Canada, why can't you do it in New Zealand or Australia? Why didn't you do it in the United States? And we have, and this is in the late 2000s, we have our own standard here, and couldn't they have done it here? I mean, arguably the ARDSnet, you know, that was dealing with a similar population, ICU bound, and they got consent, right, from surrogates and the like. In fact, the ARDSnet, I think they didn't do it in, it wasn't run in some states, maybe California or something, where they couldn't use surrogates. There was no law that kind of allowed them to use surrogate consent to people, put people into research like this. So I know that there were some places where they couldn't run that trial because of the need to get consent and the inability to get a surrogate, which is interesting. But makes the trials really difficult to do. But
so is it your opinion, do you think that was really truly emergency research and should have been, had a waiver, or?
Oh, that's a good question. So this isn't really emergency.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it. So yeah. That's what I'm wondering, because it's so hard here to get it approved for emergency from informed consent. That doesn't necessarily seem to meet the requirement, at least in the U.S., so.
Right. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's an emergency rate waiver thing that wouldn't work.
Yeah.
But then the question is whether or not something else would.
Right.
Could you get a waiver on similar grounds under Section 116D of the Common Law?
Yeah.
Is it more than minimal risk? I don't know. These are very sick people. Mortality is very high. It gets back to the minimal risk definition again, right? You've used these people who are at a fairly, you know, 30-40% chance of dying, or a healthy individual. So anyway, that's, any thoughts? Comments? All right, so what did the papers have to say about standard of care? I've spoken enough.
To tie in the guidance from SEOMS, I thought the capacity building was a... wait, let me start over. It's all dependent, I guess, on the population, it seems.
Well, let's just talk about, before we get to, I don't want to do the case. I just want
okay,
to,
yeah, I'm probably jumping.
Yeah, I mean, so what are the papers? I mean, Ruth Macklin, for instance, kind of like launches into this, and I don't know, what did she suggest, and what's her take on this? Nobody wants to get into it.
Okay.
Let me ask this. Let me ask a different question. So in all of the papers we read this week, they raised the issue about vaccine trials in HIV, and it's vaccine prevention, you know, it's a prevention trials using various strategies to avoid HIV infection. And all of them kind of talk about, well, the need to meet the standard of care, you know, what standard of care is it? And then, of course, this issue about post-trial, not even post-trial, but treating, the duty to treat people who are infected, become infected during participation in the trials. And I'm just wondering, what do you think of those issues? I mean, they really speak to the core of what we're trying to get at in this course, in a way, especially when we're developing, you know, we're dealing with populations, underserved populations. Yeah.
I was just thinking that if the standard of care excludes, certain members of the population, excludes some portion of the vulnerable population, that doesn't apply to a universal belief of how we apply distributive justice and minimizing harms. So we, as United States citizens, have to look at a standard of care as providing for everyone in the vulnerable population. So we're committed to a different standard. Mm-hmm. Even though the standard of care in the country is something is not available to a certain portion of the population, it may be because of poverty that it's not there, not because they don't want to provide it. Mm-hmm. They would provide it if they had it. A reasonable person would provide the same standard of care if they had it.
Right.
So for us, as United States citizens, we would be committed to providing what we are committed to, a universal standard of care.
But can we do that? And I mean, does that imply that we shouldn't? I mean, Ruth even says this. And does this imply that we shouldn't do research unless you're committed to do that?
Well, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask. So my opinion is that I do agree with the one point that was made about the expense. If it's an overwhelming expense, it's a non-sustainable solution. Perhaps they're better off if you're not doing anything. What good is it if you can only do something for them for the moment, and then when you're gone, they can't sustain the solution that you propose. So.
But that also speaks to the value of the research. I mean, if they're actually judging whether or not this is important research for us, which we hope that if they're doing and they have some mechanism for doing that, then the research question should be something that would be practical at the end.
Well, I think we talked about this a while ago with mother to child transmission. And I think that if it can't be, you know, sustained, I kind of agree with her, if it can't be sustained, you know, outside of just the research, you know, American funded, a lot of money, you know, kind of, I guess, structured on the way American society is structured, where most people do have access, reasonable access to a doctor at least or something, then I don't see the point of doing a trial that's like kind of structured like an American trial in a country that doesn't have the resources. I think it should be structured so that it's practical and useful to that country. You know, what, it's not ideal, but that's just how it is. So I don't know. That's kind of where I came down on it.
I would tend to argue that there needs to be more of like a human development approach built into that, some more collaboration between researchers and social workers, researchers, you know, biomedical researchers.
That's what Benatar's article kind of gets at, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But is that something that researchers, like they even say, well, the researchers aren't necessarily skilled at that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe there needs to be a third party, an advocate who can kind of speak between parties and mediate. To find the best solution for the community while also meeting the needs of the research community.
Yeah, if the health ministries or something could get involved with that, I think that would be ideal, probably. Yeah. I don't know that the researchers could really carry something like that out, but yeah, if there was some sort of entity, that would be good, I agree.
I mean, the article does say involve the community members with real decisions, if you can, and I think that would be a way to do it.
You can find out who speaks
That's
to the community.
Right.
Yeah.
that question.
Mm. I mean, in some ways, it kind of presupposes that the researchers have a long-standing relationship with the country, with the people. Right. They can't just kind of like be helicopters. I remember, I think Francis already mentioned that we were going on safari in Botswana, and we met this guy from CHOP. And he was interested in one particular disease, and he was like, there's this population, I can go study it there. Cool, I get to go on a safari while I'm there. And it was like, and that was a kind of helicopter researcher. You know, he had no relationships with Botswana. He didn't really care about Botswana. He was just kind of like, well, it's a population, I can go in and get some access to data and people and subjects and leave. And it was funny because we were just like, but what could you do? I mean, he got CHOP IRB approval, and he was just doing what he's doing. And this stuff goes on, I guess.
No, I was just going to just raise the question and go back a little bit towards the issue of standard of care. So, we're saying that, and appropriately so, that we need to sort of understand what's happening globally and being locally sensitive. But what does that tell us about the differences in care, standards of care relative to different environments? Should they all be the same? Should they be different? Should it be an issue of
what do you mean trying should?
To raise everybody or figure out what is raising standards mean in any individual environment? I think it's a complex question.
Mm-hmm. And how do you study also? I think a couple of papers brought up the issue, I think Benatar's paper mostly, that when you're doing research in a particular place, you are changing the environment. I mean, access to resources is going to change, alternative other care. I mean, there's one paper that was published where, I think it was the MRC, so the British Medical Research Council went to, I forget where they were, maybe the Zambia or something, but they were doing some research and they went in, they built facilities, and they actually wound up treating, since they had doctors on the ground and they had kind of like a clinical facility to kind of do the research, they wound up delivering care to family members, not related to the trial, but totally unrelated to the trial. And of course, the issue here in part is also, do you change the standard of care? Do you change the standard of care of treatment unrelated to what the trial is about? Do you treat people for other things and the like? I mean, there's no perfect world. You can't just kind of like collect data. I mean, you are really dealing with real people in a real settings and stuff. And which makes the research even more expensive.
Experimentalist always perturbs the system in which they're investigating.
Even by studying and just by looking at it, you can't. Self-altering effect.
Yeah, so, just reading this, I can imagine too an issue similar to what was brought up with bringing in, I guess, like the paper we were discussing earlier, and the idea of doing meta-analyses and things like this to determine what's the standard of care, what's best practices or evidence-based medicine, versus coming into the community on their level and speaking with community leaders on what they want or what they view as what they want the researchers to provide as a bare minimum to participants. I mean, I would imagine that would be a challenge, especially if the researcher's goal, kind of as a helicopter researcher, I guess, would be like, oh, I want to get this published in a journal, and then they're balancing that with, connecting with the community and community engagement. But yeah, I would imagine that would be, I guess, part of the responsibility of the researcher too.
And all, but also all these things that we do and kind of alters the environment, limits the external validity and exportability of the trial results. Right. And it's funny because we'll talk about it with the trial that we have tonight, and it raises some real questions whether that should have been done at all, but it's the same kind of issue, I guess. But so any other, I guess, these things, we've talked about the standard of care across these things, and I guess perhaps the best way to do this would be to do the case, to just launch into it. I know last week Frances said she let you kind of break up into groups and come at this from different approaches. Did anybody, you like that approach? Was that valuable? Should we do it again? So who are the interest, what are the interest groups? This is the home treatment of malaria, right? In the basement of up to five-year-olds. So what are the interest groups that would be involved in some way in this?
Investigators.
The researchers. Are they from here or where are they from? Do we know?
From Hopkins.
Any and hopefully some from home? From Tanzania?
Yeah. Yeah, there were...
Throw my theory.
Are you
reading the paper, it's hard to... Yeah.
Morrow is from Hopkins. I don't know if the other person is local or not. Yeah.
I don't know this name, Kidane. It seems like an African name. I don't know.
Yeah,
among the authors.
Note also about this paper, they don't say anything about ethical approval anywhere.
Yeah, no, that's not
Yeah.
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 So that's the other thing is, it's not clear from that paper if there are more than two groups that would be involved, at least the way I read it, and that was the local villagers and the investigators. Was there another, you know, was there somebody from, you know, from an official from Ethiopia that was sort of involved in some way, shape, or form?
Well, they referred to community leaders that kind of handed out the medicine previously, so, but who knows who those
are. So they also thank, let's see, they thank the UNDP, World Bank and WHO's special program, the Regional Health Bureau, the Regional Health Bureau of Tigray, the Department of Malarial Control in Mekelle.
Yeah, but thanking them could be just, you know, they said, sure, go ahead.
Yeah.
Stakeholders.
Well, I guess what we, well, so this speaks to who's interested in this stuff, right? Clearly, the funder, maybe we can generalize and say the funding agency,
mm-hmm.
sponsor.
Well, so they receive support from?
Yeah, the UNDP and all,
yeah,
right?
And all those
things. So we have researcher sponsors. What about the?
The moms.
The
moms?
Moms?
Kids? Yeah.
Okay, moms. Well, all moms? As a family, as a group? Is it just the moms or is it?
The mother coordinators.
Anybody else? Do you want the moms or do you want the families?
Mothers, sure. Mother coordinators.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking like the family, the kids, the families, the
families.
People whose children are dying of malaria.
Then there were people who were these coordinators who were also paid.
Right, that's about coordinators. So what about the villages themselves, village leaders or something, or the leaders of these, what are they called, what's the word, tabias? How would that be broken up? I don't know if there are clusters of villages. I wonder, does a village have would a tabias, do anybody know, would a tabias have a organization behind it, or is it just?
If I take it in reference to Tanzania, we have leaders from Tense leaders, we go have suburb, then we go village leaders.
So there's leaders at all different levels?
Yeah.
So let's keep it the villages, which
okay.
might be generalizable.
Yeah.
And the villages are the ones it's the tabias that were randomized.
Yeah.
But the villages or the village, basically the community leaders. Is there a Department of Health or Ministry of Health?
Right, it's not involved in this paper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they do say the Department of Malarial Control. So. Right. But would that be all within the ministry? Can we generalize? Let's a minute. Yeah, let's say the ministry. Anybody else?
About the children.
Well, the funny thing is, we said that the families, the moms, represent the children, and the kids have independent interests separate from their moms, their families.
They were trying to, people were trying to protect their life and liberty, if you may.
Does anybody want to play role play the child?
Yeah.
Is there an IRB? We don't know if there's any IRBs or anything like that.
That's
and Hopkins. How about Hopkins? Is Hopkins an interest? Does Hopkins have an interest?
Are they the sponsor?
No.
No, just the...
It's where Morrow works.
Hmm.
Yeah, well, I think they definitely have an interest.
So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I have researchers, sponsors, mom coordinators, families, village, village or community leaders, the Ministry of Health, Johns Hopkins. What about the other care providers?
The previous care provider.
Yeah.
Health workers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And their the organization, so the clinics that exist already.
They were the CHW?
Yeah, well, that's what the workers were called.
Community task workers.
So it is a community-based malarial control program with volunteers. They volunteer CHWs. So that's a separate group, it sounds like. It sounds like one village used a couple of those people to be the mom coordinators. Other than that, it was all moms. It's a separate group. Yeah, I think so. Anybody? Yes, no?
Well, I don't know as far as the research if they... I mean, maybe they have an impact on them if the mom coordinators steal their jobs. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, they are volunteers.
Yeah. So they don't get paid anyway. Okay. I'm not sure about them.
Okay, we'll leave them out. If anybody wants to throw them in, we can throw them in. So we have... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 groups. Researchers, sponsors, mom coordinators, families, village community leaders, Ministry of Health, and Hopkins. How did you break up last week? Just kind of go around the table? Or?
Yeah, just people that you were
here. People in memory.
Yeah, like, she was like these three. Excellent.
She's good. She's I'm not like that. Okay, so we have 7 groups and we have 14, 15. How many people we have? 17.
Too many groups.
There's too many groups. I think we can get all kind of.
How about mom coordinators and families together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think the researchers in Hopkins can kind of be together, or somebody, the sponsors. I don't know.
I'm wondering actually if the community leaders and the families would they be aligned all the time? Not based on prior experience. Okay. Researchers and sponsors, you think?
Yeah, or researchers in Hopkins, maybe. I don't know that they really have different
Hopkins. Interests. Let's take Hopkins out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so now we're down to researchers, sponsors, families, coordinators, the village and community leaders, and the ministry. That's 5. Okay, so that's 3 per group plus a little bit. Okay. So you 3?
Sure.
Okay. Researchers?
Okay.
You guys? Sponsors, you guys down there, families, put a different spin on. And then you 3 can be, you in fact make it you 4, can do village and community leaders, and then you 3 can be Ministry of Health.
Yeah, so we're supposed to kind of
This is a break for group discussions.
She went around like clockwise.
Counterclockwise. So, what are the issues? And you want to go counterclockwise? So, you guys were the Ministry of Health.
Yeah. We had a couple issues with it. We thought that as the ministry, we would think it was great that they were trying to reduce the overall under 5 mortality, but that because we were an area with not a great infrastructure. Medical infrastructure and like health worker infrastructure, that it was sort of problematic that the study was allowing mothers to give the drug because chloroquine is a pretty toxic drug if given in the wrong circumstances, and that we didn't really know what the like Ministry of Health's position would be on having like an unlicensed healthcare worker administering a medication, but that it was problematic, especially because it could lead to resistance, and that would cause long-term increases in mortality if we had higher resistance to chloroquine. So we sort of thought that even though it was great that was aiming to reduce mortality, that in the long run it might be a bad issue.
Okay. Who's next? Next.
Village leaders. Leaders.
So what do you think of that? First, we'll get back to think. What do you think of that?
We actually weren't sure what to make of the fact that you had untrained health, de facto health workers, mothers administering this care. And it kind of seemed to run counter to the Declaration of Helsinki, which sort of mandates that you'll have physicians or at least trained scientific and medical personnel administering care. Mm.
It would, of course, at least the World Medical Association.
But as for the priorities of the village coordinators, I guess they would be looking for to maintain a relationship with the researchers, improving access to care for their community. They might want to gain closer ties to the Ministry of Health. I'm not really sure how the bureaucracy is set up here. They may be wishing to change the standard of care to something closer to that of a more developed country.
What is the standard of care?
Essentially nothing. They have really ineffective treatment from the malaria prevention department or whatever. So the standard of care is slim, if existent at all.
So if you let's say this works, would you care? I hate to kind of like jump off on this, but what? I mean, there are options. Mm-hmm. Right, there's kind of like deliver drugs or there's deliver nets, for instance.
Right.
And we know the nets work, for instance. So how do you feel about that? It's you're the village. I mean, and also when you discuss this as a village, are you the village that's going to get randomized to nothing? And how do you feel about that?
I think that was something we discussed quite a bit, is the real importance of communicating exactly what the control group means and reading the papers. To us, we were talking a lot about what were the mother coordinators doing in the control group, and it was hard to tell from just reading the paper, but you would imagine it might have had some variability if they weren't given clear instructions as to what to do. Like, can they provide, you know, at least advice on prevention measures such as mosquito nets, or are they just completely withdrawn and tallying deaths of children?
I think the way I read it, they were collecting data, but they could also give referrals to health clinics and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Right? And after 2 days, in the experimental arm, I think they could refer to the medical professionals.
We know that doesn't
work. Right.
But so what is a village? I mean, is a village willing to kind of take this? It's like, well, there's an intervention out there. We believe it works. And we're going to randomly assign you to maybe not to get it. If you're the village elder, would you care?
I should, almost certainly.
You should.
Yeah.
So, and then also relates to the standard of care. I mean, you could have nets. You could also have prophylaxis. We know prophylaxis works. Well, do we? I guess we don't. Do and we don't.
Works.
You still have the same issue about potential resistance.
Yeah, but I mean, like, at least I mean, what we were talking a little bit about, it was when I read it, it was confusing as to whether or not chloroquine was available before the researchers came in. Like, was that, did the health workers have that and it was just a problem that the moms weren't getting their kids there fast enough? Or did Johns Hopkins or whoever provide like much better access to the chloroquine and that? I don't know. Like, it was unclear to me.
It seemed like what happened was that obviously the community was already trying to solve the problem because you couldn't get access to the health, and mothers and infants couldn't get access to the healthcare system, and that's where the chloroquine was. And the WHO provides chloroquine free to everybody. The question whether it was there or not, they don't specifically say, but it sounded like if you went to the healthcare at the community center, you got treated.
Right.
And the problem was not, and the people that went got treated, but only the infants, because of the rapid disease,
right,
and because mothers couldn't actually travel to the site, weren't able to get access.
And it was old, right? It was also fairly old, and they knew. In fact, this guy mentioned reference number 24, which gets fairly short shrift in this paper, talks about maternal administration of chloroquine. It's from 1988. So there was some evidence out there that moms could do it. In fact, they did that, and they trained moms. I couldn't pull the paper down. It's not available on the web just now. And but they trained moms, and they had something. And their summary of it in the paper was, the approach seems straightforward. It's been, 24. Where is it? I thought it was kind of dismissive.
I think it was done for that. There were some respiratory kind of interventions where the mother was taking care of the kid. And it's done in perinatal transmission because mothers in the bush have to be able to get nevirapine to be able to prevent transmission. And so you actually provide nevirapine to the mother and infant.
Mm-hmm.
And when the mother's going to deliver, she has a picture that says,
take this.
This is what you do. You take the nevirapine and then you give nevirapine to the baby. And that was created as a solution because there really is no other solution.
Mm-hmm. As long as they have a heat-stable drug.
Yeah, it was. And nevirapine was the same issues because if you treated for a longer time with nevirapine, essentially all the virus becomes resistant. So you don't use nevirapine as a long-term treatment, but if you use it as a one-time dose at the time of delivery, you don't really have to worry that much about resistance.
Hmm. Okay, we'll come back to you guys. You were the mothers.
We were outraged by the whole thing, by the implication that I'm not smart enough to be able to give the drugs,
mm-hmm.
Or that I wouldn't do that if I saw my kid who was sick and I knew that I couldn't get him or her to the community center. The idea that I couldn't be trained to do this, or that actually it was happening already before Hopkins came in, that the community had decided to try to solve this problem by putting this program in place. Whether Hopkins, when they came in, made it more effective or not is up for grabs, I think, in the way the paper is written. But we had already decided as a community that we were going to do this, and when Hopkins came in, they decided they wanted to study it. And then they chose to randomize me to get nothing, when the fact of the matter is that there were plenty of other options, not the least of which was just give me the chloroquine, because chloroquine works. There are some issues of toxicity, but toxicity versus death is probably not that much of a concern. The drug's available. The only thing that's a problem is that I can't get my child to the drug. So you either have to bring the drug to me, or you have to give me the drug so I can give it to my child, and I won't get randomized to something that doesn't give me something. And in this case, if my child's actually, it's not like I'm trying to prevent malaria, which would be a different story. This is, I'm going to treat a child who has a febrile illness, and if I'm going to do that, then I need the drug. The net would be great in addition, but it's not going to solve the problem of treating my child who's sick.
So do you think you had any voice in this?
No, because, I would have actually, maybe, if Hopkins, I have no idea what the consent situation was. I mean, what people told me to do or told me not to do or gave me any information about doing.
You didn't even know if the village elders were involved.
Right.
Right.
And I also don't want to be in a position, because some of the mothers were coordinators, that you allow me to, you recruit me to be a mother coordinator, and I'm supposed to be educated then about malaria, but then I'm supposed to keep that information away from people that are in the other group, right? I mean, I don't know how I could be a coordinator if I wasn't trained in the whole study.
But yeah, you could have been blinded. Yeah, you could have been blinded to what the other arm was.
Well, I could have been, but I don't know.
I bet. I mean, otherwise, how could you? It's like, oh, there's this drug, but I'm not allowed to give it to you.
You should move to this other village.
That's right. Yeah. And the, yeah, but because the, yeah, then as a mom, would you, and you knew that if you had been trained, you would try to get the pills yourself. Right. And that's not fair. Okay, next.
We were the sponsoring funding agencies, and in the acknowledgement sections, it mentions the WHO special program as well as the World Bank. Mm-hmm. So we were trying to think about this in terms of the regulations that WHO has already set forward. And one of our primary concerns was the creation of a double standard in developed versus developing nations, and the concept that this trial could never have been carried out in a developed country, both for the reason that it's really not applicable to the needs of the developed world, and also they would never have it carried out there. We were also concerned about maintaining confidentiality. It didn't seem like there were good guidelines in place for that. We were concerned with the whole issue of the placebo-controlled study design. As these issues have been raised by the mothers, we saw that the whole study design being kind of problematic, and maybe the placebo no intervention arm should have been, if not eliminated, there should have been some kind of therapy or better intervention. And we also raised concerns about administering only the chloroquine in the absence of antibiotic, because children often have co-infection with bacterial infections and they could be prone to sepsis. So they're usually treated, they're usually treated with antibiotic and chloroquine. So giving them only chloroquine, if they also have bacterial infection, could just lead to sepsis and it could be causing deaths anyways.
Would that be recorded on their retrospective from Renata Dina? Would that be categorized as a malarial death?
The problem we have is that malaria and other infections like sepsis, you cannot really tell by just symptoms. You have to kind of do the exams and see is this bacterial infection or is it malaria. And then the other issue is even in the treatment of malaria itself, you need to have the parasite be able to decide this needs a chloroquine or this other one needs like admission and quinine and something else. And then the other issue is in areas where you don't have like these investigative methods, they have the WHO recommendation that you give antibiotic and anti-malaria. And that is WHO recommendation in resource poor countries. Mm-hmm. But in this paper,
was that, do you know if that related back to the 90s, the mid 90s, or late 90s?
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, this has been in press for a long time.
Oh, really?
Because especially for kitties complex.
They have a rapid diagnostic test in every dispensary, the very first level of the healthcare, so you can easily tell if it is malaria. But in the past, you don't have that rapid test, so you have to do give them antibiotic and give them anti-malaria, then you check the child. If there is improvement within some few hours, then you continue. If there is no improvement after first dose, you decide to transfer this child to hospital. But in this paper, they say they keep them for 48 hours. I think it's just too long. But if child has sepsis and you have given your anti-malaria and then you keep this child for 48 hours, you are going to lose the child when the child is to the hospital.
Hmm. Although, I guess the healthcare system was so, I guess, dysfunctional, maybe they didn't have that option. I don't know.
They say they have community health facility, but they really didn't specify what is it is doing. I can't really tell.
Yeah. You know, this paper has a lot of things which are unclear.
Right.
When they say that Delaware, the health center, but the many kids could die before they get service, so we don't know if they arrive there on time when the facility was overcrowded or the facilities are very far. So there are many things which or they arrive there, there is no health worker, though, which we know for sure was available, chloroquine available, that's where they had enough to distribute everywhere.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. So this is the researchers. Evil researchers.
We found that the current standard of care, the CHW group, even though you could argue that they're ineffective, there's still at least maybe someone getting some level of care from them. And so we're proposing an intervention group that has not been proven as well, because we feel the uncertainty of benefit from either is equal, and so therefore we can put our trial into place. Does that make sense?
Because we think it's more scientifically sound to have a strict control
than some
and intervention. And since they do have some access to care, we don't think that we're really withholding standard of care.
Yeah, I'm lost.
We're just trying to justify our reasons for setting up the trial.
Like us to sign.
We're supposed to take the side of the researchers. That's what we did last week.
Well, what are your motivations as a researcher?
We want to help people, you know.
Right. So you could be somebody from Hopkins. You could be somebody, from there.
Right. And, you know, we also obviously want to get good data and to get it published. So I think it's better if we do a scientifically sound model.
Okay.
That's our evil researcher perspective. Obviously, we don't think
so. Our intent is there. I mean, we're
right.
Teaching these mothers to,
I think it's
in
a really
7
great
days,
plan.
To go out and, you know, maybe teach someone else within 7 days or have the researchers do that. I mean, if this does work, it is a... It does uphold a large prospect to the rest of, you know, any of the other communities that have this kind of, you know, condition.
So did you consider any other designs before you implemented this?
We went with our gut instinct.
Yeah, we didn't really.
This was it.
We didn't really think about it. We were like, no, that's it. Let's do that.
That's basically how it seemed.
Can I introduce you to the village elder?
I know.
Or one of the moms from.
We're really more interested in the science here. So.
Probably, I think the researcher knew that we had the sensor data from the sensor, which showed the mortality before the implementation of the new intervention. I don't know why they used to have a new control. Why didn't they use those data as a control?
Yeah. So why not use a historic control?
They made a point in the paper of how good the survey systems were. They had actually done surveys before, so the data was pretty reliable.
Data's in the paper, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Although I have to say, that, I don't know if you looked at it, if you compare table... If you compare their table 1... The rate ranged from, this is under 5 mortality per rate per 1,000, ranged from 8.4 to 158.3. That was in 1996, right? And then if you look at their results data, the mortality rate ranged from, well, the mean was 50.2. Let's see, the mean, there's the mean there. Mean on the left-hand side, but the range, it was much smaller. So they would need more. I think they would need more data. I think the variability depends on weather and everything else, and you know, there's so much variability that, and because if you look at it, actually,
when they said that, they talked about geography too.
Yeah, it's geography and
so
weather,
like,
and
yeah.
So I mean, it's so variable.
Yeah.
I mean, some ways you'd need a lot of historical data, I think, to be able to detect a signal here. And that
unless
might be one reason.
Geography that was specifically, you know,
yeah.
The sentinel kind of geography.
Right.
Sites or something.
Yeah, but I mean, the rates, so, I mean, if you look at the mortality rate, and so I just kind of went through and looked at the pre and post and just put them down.
Oh.
I mean, the 158 before was 20.7 after it was a treatment group. And then the 121 was a non-treatment group, and that dropped to 35.7. That was 35.7 in the second
group. So it was still better even without the intervention.
Oh, substantially. I mean, it was,
yeah.
121 down to 35.
Yeah.
And the highest rate that I see on here is like 80. And that was in something that was 14 before. So it's your variance is extremely large. So you're getting a lot of fluctuation. So to be able to see a signal, you'd need a really good, rich, historical kind of like trend. And kind of such a, and then you'd have to probably do it more than 1 year.
I mean, the efficacy of chloroquine is reasonable, and the magnitude of the difference when they actually did the study was pretty significant. So it wasn't a subtle signal you were looking for, although you'd have to do a lot because of the benefit.
Right. But yeah, historic controls might have been a reasonable approach to this. It would still have gotten you guys published. It might have not been as robust and believable. So what about negotiation between the different interest groups? Where should, for instance, should moms or the communities have been involved in this decision about what this design should look like? Whether or not it should be research, or should it just be a kind of a public health intervention? It's on its face, it's like, this is a good idea. Maybe there's some downsides, but this is, there's already some evidence that this works. It makes a lot of sense. Why not try it? Or
the actual community came to us moms before you came as the researcher, and it specifically says that they involved us in the decisions about how to set up this whole program. But the research part of it doesn't say that you came. I don't think it says that you came to us.
So you'll get it next year. Some of you will get it next year, if it works.
Yeah, it seems to me like it should have been more of a public health initiative, really, because if they've already sort of had a similar model, and it seems like it was reasonable to train non-physicians and non-healthcare people to give the drug to the children. So I don't know, I think they could have either rolled it out like that or just compared it to historical data instead of withholding the intervention from the other group.
So is the ministry, where would the ministry be involved in? Would the ministry be involved in this kind of decision at that level? And the ministry obviously would be supportive of the public health intervention. But are they, where would they come down on the research aspect?
It would depend on what kind of benefit we got. Like, sustainability-wise, would we get, if it contributes to a more productive healthcare workforce that can help out long-term, then that's great. But I don't know.
So do you need to have some kind of commitment? I noticed that they didn't have any commitment or didn't say anything about any commitment to kind of like do this more broadly, longer term.
It seems like the central question is whether this data is going to lead the ministry to some sort of action, like on a broader scale. And if they don't have the resources to do that already, then it would, if they don't have the resources to implement the program that would be suggested by this research, then it would seem that it wasn't entirely useful for that nation or the communities being studied.
Mm-hmm. Leads to the bigger question of what's the point of this? If there's a high probability, as Ed was saying, that this can be inferred that it would work. So what new knowledge are you generating? To what ends or what public health ends or public value?
Mm-hmm. It would only have value if you were actually going to convince somebody to put more money into it to make it work better. Mm-hmm. Or it seemed to me that the other person who could benefit was that somebody who wasn't convinced that they should do it already. That the community was already convinced, that somebody else could be convinced, but then why do it here? Why not do it there, where they're already not doing it? Right? Here they are doing it.
Unless there was another question maybe about sort of the social structure of sort of the community and sort of how things were dispersed and how it worked. If there was something novel about that that they were trying to answer, then that might lead to the new knowledge that could be transferable to other places and times as well as locally, but that didn't seem to be the case.
Well, they have that last sentence of the whole article that's very telling, and it's basically saying that you doubt the applicability of the study for other areas.
Yes.
So why bother doing it? Mm-hmm. So what about the standard? Let's get back to the standard of care. I think that there's some parallels here with those other studies. It's like there are various other options available that are implementable if you're willing to pay for it. I guess my concern always here is that you don't really know costs. They don't say anything about the cost of this versus the cost of NETs versus the cost of prophylaxis. So you have all these alternatives that you could be implementing. And at the end of the day, it's like, well, do we pay for this or do we pay for those other things? You still don't have any comparators to work with. So which actually might make it difficult for the ministry to kind of like say, well, what are we interested in doing? Or why do this instead of NETs? Maybe NETs would work a lot better, but NETs are a little bit more expensive. or a lot more expensive. I don't know. How much does an ed cost? Anybody know?
I mean, they're less than a dollar or something. They're actually pretty cheap.
Really?
Well, there, a lot of them are distributed in community programs, but I don't know. I mean,
do you guys distribute nets, do you know, Tanzania?
Yeah, they distribute nets for pregnant women. And if the woman did deliver in the hospital and still have a kid, I think under five, they get nets for free.
Interesting.
Actually, they distribute nets twice every year, but it's for the families with under five.
Under five.
Mm-hmm. If you don't have under five, you don't have
Do you know how long they've been doing that?
I think I've taken like four times. I'm not really sure when was that.
But I remember it started along, it was within 2000, and it became even more implemented, I think, after Bush VST brought a lot of nets.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm.
So it's kind of an emerging standard of care.
Yeah, Bush was like accelerating it. It was there, actually. Mm-hmm. So, like, it was like expanding it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Okay. So is there any obligation to the communities, because they didn't really say anything about this, but what are the obligations to the communities that were randomized to the control group? It's like, oh, thank you very much. By the way, we didn't really train your moms very well last year.
The thing I don't know here, which actually this you cannot get it from this paper, is that these people is like they are not told that they are being involved in a study. Probably they are told that this is a new approach of treatment we are implementing. So
you're you're arguably the kind of the ultimate controller of access to people and the protector of the public's interest in this. Where would you have liked to have seen what controls and what protections would you have liked to have seen in place? What IRBs should have approved this?
Yeah, actually, the thing actually also which we don't find in this paper, that this study was approved by an ethical board.
Was it? You don't know?
We don't know.
It's an interesting question. I wonder if the standards for publishing that kind of detail have changed in these journals. We know that detail has changed in a lot of biomedical journals in the last 15, 20 years, where people are now requiring at the International Council of Medical Journal Editors requires it, and most journals require it now. Back in 2000, maybe not. But it also really just begs the question whether or not they did it. So, any others? Do we owe anything to the people who are in the controls? I mean, they paid a price. Or did they? In the community members? I mean, community people, do you think that you know, if the standard of care, this is always the argument, right? The standard of care is nothing, therefore you got nothing, therefore no harm.
But they gave up their data, and people could use that for some kind of...
Yeah, but they weren't made worse off, though, were they?
No.
Or were you? Do you feel worse off?
Sure, because the community was trying to implement this in the first place.
Right.
So I would have at least probably gotten something.
You didn't sign up. So you didn't sign up for this.
Yeah, and so I didn't even know that it would be randomized. So nothing used to be this. I had no other choice before, but now that everybody knows that it's a problem, they've been trying to implement something to help us. But now I got randomized for a trial where I didn't get it.
And also they were subjected to these verbal autopsies. I mean, psychologically, I mean, you're grilling someone about how your kid died. Like, could you tell me the details about, the symptoms of your kid before they died? I mean, that's pretty intense.
Is that something that happened before, though? Because didn't they have data on it, or was that more?
That method, I guess the method existed before.
Yeah.
Also, they're imposing an idea of what the standard of care was on every village, and there is sure to be some variability from village to village. So say some village leader you know, had a village where the mothers were mostly randomized, or entirely randomized, sorry, to the, you know, the control arm. And they had a village where, you know, maybe the community health, the chloroquine treatments weren't working very well at community health centers in most villages, but in my village it was working, you know, pretty well. And now we've withdrawn that, or at least not withdrawn it maybe, but...
Yeah, I don't think they.
Yeah,
I don't think they altered
on it, but
I don't think they altered the environment. No. I don't think they changed the environment.
Yeah.
In that way, like I don't think they retracted anything. They just added these moms. The moms were. I think the moms got trained in different ways.
Yeah, I mean,
that's the only way it could work.
It was hard to tell exactly what the intention was for them.
Well, I think that in that case, you could argue that well, we still provided all this training and the coordinators taught all the other moms, you know, how to recognize it and how to refer. So you could say, that, you could argue that they did get some benefit from it in the control group.
Yeah, I don't think they actually said what the...
Yeah, they didn't specify, exactly.
As opposed to what was already there.
Yeah.
They just...
But both groups did have the coordinators, the mother coordinators.
The mother coordinators were in Grant. Were there,
yeah.
They were trained in something.
But the
yeah.
thing,
what it doesn't say what.
In this paper, they say those who got trained is only in the intervention group. That is actually, they are the ones who taught about the symptom and how to administer the medication and how to refer. But the paper is totally quiet on what was happening in the control group. What we know that they were told to collect the data and those verbal autopsies.
Evan said they had a lot less mother coordinators in the control group because they weren't doing anything. They didn't have much to do.
Yeah. That's true. So it's per 15 to 44 versus the other one was 10 to 22. Right. Yeah.
Instead
that's
of putting them there and giving them something to do.
Yeah.
Hmm. Actually, telling about the, I think it's telling that with the, just struck me is that the mortality rate was much, I think it was lower. Sorry, just kind of. I believe it was lower. Though I can't definitively say this. It might have been. I don't think it was lower. In fact, in the control group, than it had been in the basic condition. So I was just thinking maybe this intervention, maybe even the control intervention had some effect. But speaking to the historic value of the historic controls, you couldn't tell the difference, even if it did. Not that it would be much, but I don't think there was any at all. So what about dissemination? What is there an obligation and is there a need to kind of like work this out beforehand? Because these guys, it looks like they were going to implement something anyway, and now they'll go ahead and implement it knowing that it didn't, knowing with, I guess, with more surety that it works. And was that worth it? I think it speaks to the social value of it.
It's the importance of, is there a question here? The question they asked was, is there a question here?
Well, in some sense, they're kind of creating the question, though, right? They look at the evidence and they kind of create uncertainty. We don't really, I mean, they're basically saying, we don't know if this will work.
But that's the question. We don't know if it works or will it cause harm. So therefore, there's a question there. Should we implement it? Will it work? And for the money, that's the value, and then well, if we implement it, could it cause harm? So that's the risk benefit.
But they didn't ask, they don't even talk about money in here.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. That would be the reason to do those if those things were unknown. But we don't know because we don't have a context and any further context other than just the nice Hopkins guys sort of show up and think they can get a cool study. Cool study out of this because it's not certain what the answer is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to implement things from a public policy perspective, right, without being certain about it.
But some of the things that they use as arguments to say that there might be harm are a little questionable to start with. So the harm would be that if I'm the mother, I can't do it. That's a little presumptive. And
there was actually that reference 24 shows that moms can do it.
Can do it, right.
And that was old.
And the argument about resistance is a rational public health argument, but it's not really a rational public health argument when there isn't resistance in the community, but there is death in the community, and you have a therapy that's going to treat it. Resistance really isn't a problem. The problem is not getting medicine that you need to treat the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys know better than I, but chloroquine-resistant malaria is common in other places, mostly because of the use of the drug, but you could still argue whether it's because of inappropriate use of the drug or because the drug's just widely used because malaria is prevalent. So.
Interesting. And what this, the question that was raised for me in part was, do researchers, you know, if they're going to plan a clinical trial, how well do they capture what's been done and capture and summarize what's been done before? You know, it's actually the same thing that happened in the other trial we talked about earlier. It's like, well, how well do they really know, and how well? I mean, it's in their interest. You're evil researchers. You know, in their interest to kind of like undersell in a way the clinical trial, or overstate the uncertainty. Right?
Absolutely.
Especially for one that came out just, you know, a couple months before you submitted your grant. And we know, I've mentioned it here before, but there was this analysis of meta-analyses of clinical trials. Did I mention that here? You guys know this? I should actually distribute this because it's an interesting one, but it's, they basically went back, it was a great design, but they went back and the researchers went back and they looked at all the meta analyses published from 1966 or something like that till today, in a particular area, and then they pulled all the meta analyses, then they pulled all the clinical trials that had been done, that had been cited by the meta analyses, right, and then they looked at whether or not those clinical trials cited clinical trials that had been published at least 1 year before they started or something like that. Or no, it was one, if they cited clinical trials that had been published at least more than 1 year prior to the publication of the clinical trial itself. And what do you think the rate was?
It was really low.
Low, I bet, yeah.
It was low? Rate of non-citing. The rate of non-citing was like 30%. And that's ludicrous, right? It's criminal.
That's the whole point. Is that, you know, each new study really has to build completely on the understanding of your previous knowledge. Is this a relevant question? Is this going to help me? Is this a relevant question to ask? I used to see that all the time early on when a lot of these sort of networks started to sort of develop. It was sort of like, well, this is an interesting question. Maybe we should answer it. I think this is an interesting question. Okay, let's do a clinical trial on it. But it's either, who cares? It doesn't really answer anything, and it doesn't. The biologic plausibility of the information doesn't lead you to believe that you should be doing that study to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Peer review doesn't really capture it either. I mean, the fact is that for those clinical trials, peer review didn't capture the fact that they weren't citing other clinical trials. And in getting funded, I mean, the peer review system is basically kind of like it's a small set of people drawn from relevant disciplines, but they may not have the most relevant experience and disciplinary background, and they're not going to go off and do a kind of like unless they're working in exactly the same area, they're not going to know the literature as well as the PI. So the PI is actually skirting somebody, or for political reasons or other self-aggrandizement or whatever else, it's kind of like avoiding somebody else or something that actually anticipates the work that they want to do. It's not clear that it'll be picked up, which I think is a problem. So it'd be actually interesting if anybody's looking for a master's project to kind of like try to reproduce the meta-analysis thing with actual clinical trials. But the meta-analysis was a fascinating approach to it. But anyway. So that's any other issues here? Can we get the standard of care issue down? Okay. Thanks. See you next week. One of the things, there's two things that are happening. One of the things, well, the one thing that's happening, I'll give it out next week, but it'll be for 2 weeks from now, is the Secretary's Bioethics Commission, whatever it's called right now, or the President's Bioethics Commission, has asked for feedback on the on research in children on kind of emergency, like anthrax and kind of like other things. And that just came out 2 days ago. And I was thinking that this might be something we could actually do. So there's a report that was done by, figured it was the National Academies or something, but I'll distribute it that way. There's an executive summary to the report that kind of like raises some of the issues about the research in children in these settings. And in 2 weeks, we're talking about kind of research in kind of like emergence of situations, like war kind of things. So this is pretty relevant to that. And if we can come up with some kind of analysis, I mean, they're asking for comments. We could even try, if we think it's worthwhile after discussing it, we could actually do a class thing. So I'll distribute that this week. Okay, thanks. Have a great week.
Yeah, you too.